You're listening to Valley Edition. Last week, Central California took center stage in Washington, D.C. when House Republicans elected Bakersfield's Kevin McCarthy as the next majority leader. He's the first Californian to hold that post, replacing Eric Cantor, who lost his seat in a primary upset. Joining us now to tell us more about the remarkable rise of Kevin McCarthy is a familiar voice to many Valley Public Radio listeners, political junkie Ken Rudin. Welcome to Valley Edition.
Thanks so much for having me. And yes, it is a very rapid rise for Kevin McCarthy.
He began his service in the House in 2006. Is this atypical to have someone ascend to the top of the leadership of his party in such a quick fashion, especially in a state that's not known as being a Republican stronghold?
Well, it's not unprecedented, but it certainly is unusual, given the fact that the new majority leader, Kevin McCarthy, was first elected to the House in 2006. Now his whip, Stephen Scalise of Louisiana, was first elected to the House in 2008. There's an impatience in Congress lately, especially among the Republicans, where once upon a time you had to be there for, like, you know, I mean, if you were elected in 1066, then you become the majority leader or something like that. But now it's a rapid rise. People don't stay that long, unless you're Charlie Rangel, who's running for renomination today in New York. But for the most part, they're impatient, they're aggressive, and they want to move up fast. Not that Kevin McCarthy is that aggressive. I mean, what's fascinating about McCarthy, I mean, he was elected to the state assembly in 2002, and he was a minority leader in 2004. So, I mean, everybody who knows him, everybody who's watched him in action, have been impressed with him, have loved the fact that his personality, his charm, his savvy, and he's just, you know, he's just a winning over kind of personality kind of guy.
If he lived in another state, one that had politics statewide that was more friendly to Republicans, do you think he would have other ambitions and that maybe majority leader wouldn't be the place that he's going? Your thoughts on that? Does part of this have to do with California?
Well, you know, it's possible. Look, the bench of the Republican Party in California is pretty dismal. Nobody thinks that Kashkari is going to come close to Jerry Brown in November. But once upon a time, you know, House members were thought to be looking at statewide runs. David Dreyer, the longtime chairman of the House Rules Committee, was always planning a Senate run. Pete McCloskey, of course, ran for the Senate. Bob Dornan ran for the Senate. So sometimes they run for statewide. As far as even higher office, presidential, well, you know, the last House guy who was elected president was James Garfield, and that was a couple of years ago in 1880. And then when you think of, like, people like Dick Gephardt and Jack Kemp and Mo Udall, you know, they all had presidential ambitions. But it's very difficult to run for president from a House district. But McCarthy, you know, as I said, good personality, very, very likable, and perhaps statewide office is not out of the cards in a state that just desperately needs some Republican stars.
What sort of a whip was McCarthy?
Well, you know, what's remarkable about it is when you think of whipping, it's almost impossible to whip this Republican conference into shape in some ways, because there's such a big chasm in the Republican Party between the Tea Party conservatives, most of whom who were elected in 2010, and the older so-called establishment veterans. And so what's remarkable about him is that he's not an ideologue, he's not a social conservative, and yet as whip he is seen as basically one of them. He's one of the rank and files, and so he is kind of a guy who is, you know, given the fierce battles between the John Boehners and the Raul Labradors of the House, the fact that Kevin McCarthy is so laid back and so seemingly unaggressive, the fact that both sides trust him is a lot to say, says a lot about Kevin McCarthy.
He's a protege of former House Ways and Means Chairman Bill Thomas, who famously got nearly three-quarters of $1 billion for his home district to build new roads and freeways back in 2005 in the transportation bill. Earmarks are different now in Washington. They're not there. Should people in the Central Valley expect Kevin McCarthy to, quote, bring home the bacon, or is this a new era in Washington and in the Republican Party now?
Oh, the latter is absolutely true. It's a new era in the Republican Party. It's a new era in Washington. And Kevin McCarthy, unlike John Boehner, he said, look, our conference is tired of the earmarks, are tired of the, you know, once upon a time, people like Thad Cochran, the senator who's up for renomination in today's Mississippi primary, would talk about the reason I should get reelected is all the money I bring home to Mississippi. That's a dirty word for Republicans now, and Kevin McCarthy agrees with that. As far as Bill Thomas, yes, I know he was Bill Thomas was his mentor. And he learned under Bill Thomas, but Bill Thomas wasn't the nicest guy in the world, shall we say. I mean, he could be prickly with the press, he can be prickly with his colleagues, and that's the complete opposite of Kevin McCarthy. So it's interesting to learn from Bill Thomas, but not to learn Bill Thomas's mistakes.
The last time the Central Valley of California had a rising political star like this, it was around 25 years ago, and Valley Congressman Tony Coelho, a Democrat who was House Whip as well, eventually brought down by a scandal. Your thoughts on that? You covered that situation back in the 80s.
I did. I was with ABC News when Tony Coelho, his junk bond deal and the personal finance scandal brought him down. He resigned from Congress in May of 1989, just as the Speaker of the House, Jim Wright, was about to go down in flames. It was not a good time for Democrats. But there is a lot to do different. There is a lot of similarities between Tony Coelho and Kevin McCarthy. Also, it's interesting. I was just thinking, Coelho left Congress when he was 47, and Kevin McCarthy is only 49. But also, Coelho became whip. He became a Democratic whip only in his fourth term. Now, Kevin McCarthy becomes a majority leader in his fourth term, whip in his third term. So even Coelho took advantage of that rapid rise. But the difference between Coelho and McCarthy is, well, the similarities, I should say, is both were very involved in personal relationships. Tony Coelho made sure he knew every colleague, every district, the lines of the district, the wives' names or the spouses' names, the children's names, their birthdays. I mean, he was very attentive to members, as is Kevin McCarthy. The thing with Coelho, though, is that money was everything to Tony Coelho. And now I'm not saying that Kevin McCarthy is not a good fundraiser. He's an excellent fundraiser, and he does distribute the money. But Coelho believed that money was the be all to whatever you want to say, call about it. It was money. With the pursuit of campaign money was everything about him. So it was money that made Tony Coelho the whip, money that put him on the path, perhaps, to Speaker. He wanted to be Speaker. He said he wanted to be Speaker not long after he was first elected to the House in 1978. But, of course, it was money that brought him down as well.
A few months ago, if you talk to a lot of political observers, they were ready to write obituaries for the Tea Party. Then with Eric Cantor's defeat, it swung the other way. The Tea Party is back in force. Does McCarthy's ascent to majority leader, does that change anything with the fortunes of the Tea Party, the way the wind is blowing, and today's races that are going on in states? You mentioned Mississippi and some of the other races. What are we seeing with the Tea Party and the Republican Party nationally?
Well, first, I think it's very lazy of the media, and everybody is part of this problem, and I don't know why they do it, but it seems like every week we have to have a scorecard about the Tea Party. They're up, they're down, they're sideways, they're inside out. It's just ridiculous. When they don't beat Mitch McConnell in Kentucky, they're down. When Eric Cantor gets beaten in Virginia, they're up. We keep just going through this schizophrenic reporting, and that's just, look, every district is different, every campaign is different. But having said that, it's just interesting to me that given the fact when Eric Cantor was defeated, and he was defeated because he wasn't conservative enough, and this guy was much more conservative than Speaker Boehner. I mean, much more conservative. But again, the Tea Party felt he wasn't conservative enough. Kevin McCarthy is not Eric Cantor regarding as far as ideology. Matter of fact, some people don't even think he has an ideology. He's just somebody who just wants to get Republicans elected. Once upon a time, that was the idea of being a Republican official, getting fellow Republicans elected. It wasn't a purity, you know, a question of purity as it was now. In today's primaries, for example, you know, Thad Cochran, the long-time senator from Mississippi, could very well go down to defeat. And he's been around a long time, elected to the House in 72, the Senate in 78. So you could say, well, the Tea Party's candidate, Chris McDaniel, if they beat him, it's a great victory for the Tea Party. And that's probably true. But Thad Cochran is showed his age. He's not been a good campaigner. He's not been responsive to a lot of things. He, believe it or not, Mississippi has this election law that, you know, you're not registered by party. So Cochran is trying to recruit African Americans to vote in the Republican off, which is just so remarkable. But so, yes, you know, the headlines will be Thad Cochran loses and the Tea Party claims a big victory. But it, like everything else, it's more complicated than that.
Yes, indeed. If you just joined us today on Valley Edition, we're talking with political junkie Ken Rudin about the latest in politics, specifically the rise of Bakersfield's Kevin McCarthy, who was elected to the position of House Majority Leader last week in Washington. Of course, you can find Ken Rudin's podcast, The Political Junkie Podcast, online at krpoliticaljunkie.com and follow him on Twitter as well. I want to turn now to California state politics in Sacramento and talk about Jerry Brown. What's old is new again in the state capitol, is it not?
Well, you know, I mean, of course, I love the fact that he's the youngest governor in history, in recent history, in California history, and the oldest governor in recent history. And a line I've been saying lately, which I just enjoy so much, is, I mean, anybody who likes politics, as I do, loves sports, and I love sports as well. And, of course, we were all intrigued by the horse race, you know, the possible triple crown the other day with the Belmont Stakes, hoping that the horse would become the triple crown winner. And I said, you know, the last time horse racing had a Triple Crown winner, the governor of California was Jerry Brown. I mean, obviously that's supposed to be a long, long time ago. And, of course, 1978 may be a long time ago, but he's also the governor in 2014. And what a remarkable story for Jerry Brown. I mean, once, you know, derided for many things, his presidential runs, the Governor Moonbeam, the sarcasm, the jokes about Linda Ronstadt, and here he is, basically doing the impossible that nobody ever expected to happen, that you have a balanced budget in California after years of horrific debt. And now Jerry Brown is fighting not only a nominal Republican challenger, Neil Kashkari, in November, but he's also battling the more progressive Democrats in his own state legislature because they want to spend it all, because we have all this money now. And he's saying, wait a second, we've gone through some really bad times. We need this rainy day fund. Don't forget what we went through. So who would have thunk that Jerry Brown would be the adult in the room? And yet Jerry Brown is proving to be the adult.
How do you think Brown's failed presidential runs maybe changed him as a politician?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and I think the same is similar of Ted Kennedy. When Ted Kennedy ran in 1980, of course, Jerry Brown also ran in 1980, but when Ted Kennedy challenged Jimmy Carter in 1980, he was seen as a playboy. He wasn't seen as a serious senator. When he lost the nomination to President Carter at the convention, when he realized he would never be president again, Kennedy became one of the great iconic senators in history, with, you know, focusing on his Senate career and issues that were dear to his heart. And Jerry Brown, too. I mean, you know, he's had a lot of paths, you know, since he ran for president in 76, only 2 years after he was elected governor. He ran again in 1980, and then he ran for the Senate in 1982 and didn't go anywhere. He lost to Pete Wilson, and then he was, mayor of Oakland, attorney general. But as governor, he seems to just realize that he, not so much about his legacy, although that could be part of it, but the fact is that there's a lot of things he sees that he desperately needs to get done. And, you know, he's not a unserious person. He's very serious about what he needs, he sees as the key issues in California, and he's just very focused on it. And it's just, you know, for somebody who's watched him for so long, as so many of you guys have done as well, it's just fascinating to see the two Jerry Browns here.
There was also his 1992 run and the 1992 Democratic Convention and his relationship with the Clintons. That is a very complex story. Has he almost pulled a page out of the Clinton book, though, with triangulating between the Republicans and the more progressive wing of his own party?
I think that's interesting. I mean, the President Clinton was derided by the progressive left when he was president, that he would just do this triangulation. And of course, you alluded to his complicated relationships with the Clintons. He basically attacked Hillary Clinton during a famous debate with Bill Clinton during the 1992 primaries. And Bill Clinton, with his famous finger wagging, went up to Jerry Brown and said, "How dare you bring my wife into this? You're not man enough." I mean, it was really not nice. You know, it's interesting to see the role he has done as governor. And he's not the kind of guy, you know, I mean, you have the scandals with the Democrats in the legislature, and you have the problems, this and that, and yet he doesn't seem to be rubbing anybody's face in it. He just says, look, I just have a job to do, and I intend to do it.
Speaking of the scandals in the state legislature, have you ever seen anything like Leland Yee, indicted on corruption and gun running charges, still gets 300,000 votes for Secretary of State in the June primary in California?
And he beat our friend Dan.
Dan Schnur, yes.
I mean, this is remarkable. I mean, not only was he seems guilty of sin, not only was he arrested, not only all these amazing charges, but he finishes double digits in the race for Secretary of State. I mean, I don't know what that says about the voters. Who knows what it says about the voters, but that was one of the more eye-opening things in the California primary on June 3rd.
One last thing on Jerry Brown. He has refused, he's been a little bit coy, he's refused to absolutely rule out a run in 2016. Should we be entirely surprised that he refuses to do that, or is that just the politician in him talking?
Well, you know, something I think is kind of a silly question. He has no interest in running for president. He's not running for president. And, of course, remember, for the longest time, he wouldn't say if he was running for re-election or not. It was he waited until the filing deadline to say, I'm running. He, you know, we always knew he was running for governor for a fourth term, a non-consecutive term. He knew he could, with all that money raised. But he's not running for president, and he's already said things like Hillary Clinton probably has it if she wants it, although there are a lot of questions about Hillary Clinton, which we can go into at some other time.
Yeah. Before we go, I want to talk about one of the really hot congressional races in this area, and that's California 21. It's David Valadao, Republican incumbent, versus Amanda Renteria, a newcomer to politics in terms of running for office, but former chief of staff for Debbie Stabenow, also worked for Senator Feinstein. She is generating a lot of money, a lot of fundraising from different groups. And what are your thoughts on that race?
Well, it's a district that look, the Democrats have not had good headlines lately. Everything between the botched rollout of the Affordable Care Act to the Bergdahl swap to the Veterans Affairs. I mean, there's a lot of things in and the foreign policy. God knows what's going on there. Democrats are really running for cover in November. She is a good candidate. She's raised a ton of money. She has a good story, and the Democrats really want this district. This district only has a Republican registration of 31%, and it's like a 50% Latino district. So here you have a Latina running for election in a district that the Democrats think should be theirs. But Valadao's done everything right. I mean, he's one of the few Republicans who realizes that there are demographic changes in this country. He needs to the Latino support. It's crucial for Republicans. He supports immigration overhaul. He opposes cuts to food stamps. It's going to be a tough race. Valadao seems to be doing everything right, but Renteria could be a rising star if she wins. But again, if Valadao wins, it makes send a signal to his fellow Republicans about immigration.
Certainly an interesting discussion, and you can continue to follow Ken Rudin's Political Junkie online. His podcast is available at krpoliticaljunkie.com. Ken, it's great to hear your voice back on our air, and we hope it's not the last time. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.